Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Flag. I'm Philip Smith, here with my esteemed colleagues, Aaron Lopez and Stephen Snow. And as you know, here at Flag, we discuss all compounding related issues. And on today's episode, we'll be discussing a few quick topics. We're going to get into the new compounding book on the New England Compounding Center tragedy, the MOU lawsuit update, another update on the NASM BHRT report, some FDA compounding warnings, dietary supplement issue, and of course, FDA's outlook on their 2021 guidance documents. As you know, because you're here, Flag has never been more accessible. You can find us on many platforms, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and podcast form, my favorite, because you don't have to look at me. Flag Podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. You can enjoy it while you drive to work, go to the gym, wherever, whenever is convenient to you. So please subscribe, give us a rating, shoot us an email, let us know what you think about this format and having it so accessible. Maybe you see too much of me. I don't know. But with that, I'll turn it over to Aaron Lopez. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Philip. Hey, we can never get too much of you. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to see you both. Hope you've had a good last few weeks.
Doing great. And Philip, to your thing about being accessible, the great thing about this platform also is that, you know, as you know, I'm traveling, so we're able to continue to do this. I appreciate the help from Adisca and getting all the technical and everything together for us. So appreciative of the work there. Just to kind of jump right into it, some of the quick topics I wanted to bring up. One of the problems that we've always had in our industry is that we see these reports on how many FDA warnings have come out, how many dings that our industry gets, and compared to other medical companies in our industry or in the medical profession, we don't see a whole lot of them. And I came across an interesting story from the regarding the Office of Prescription Drug Prevention. And if any of you guys get the updates from HPM, the law firm, on their FDA blog, they brought it to light. It was kind of interesting. They used to take all of the warning letters from the Office of Prescription Drug Prevention and those that violated and put them into one single place. All of a sudden, they disappeared and couldn't get them. And if you were to try to look at the warning letters for other FDA regulated companies, they are extremely hard to find. But if you go looking for ours, they're quite easily
easily accessible. You get it in your news alerts for ours. You get it pushed out directly to your email. It's great. Well, I'm nodding my head no. Big head no.
And the thing is that I'm all for transparency. And if there are violations, if there are warnings out there, you know, they should be, the public should be made aware of them. The problem with this, though, is it looks like the FDA is trying to now hide them and trying to bring it down a level. And, you know, I just don't appreciate that idea of it. I would love to have access to everything going on with the other FDA-regulated companies. Stephen, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I'm in favor not of taking down the compounding-related ones. I'm in favor of putting them all up. You know, you create on their website, you've got a tab for manufacturers, tab for 503Bs, tab for 503As, and anything that's an issue against anybody, it's up there and we can compare and contrast and take a look at them. It seems like that is the simplest and most straightforward way to go about it.
So you want to treat them all fairly? Is that what you want?
Kind of crazy idea.
I'm writing that down.
If the goal is truly to regulate the industry overall and to improve the overall quality of the product and the safety for patients, to me, that seems like the best way is putting the information out, making it available. In this world we live in where information is so accessible, why this information is so hard to get is interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, Stephen, to your point, getting it out there, getting it, if your intent is to have the public look at it, and to make a judgment call and put it all out there. You know, don't be so selective about it. One of the other things I wanted to bring up is, you know, as you guys know, I'm a political nerd. And if you were to see my computer in the background, yeah, as they all are nodding their heads. I've got the Georgia legislature up and playing in the background here. I've got another legislature. I'm at another state capitol today. This is my life. And the thing is, between January 1st till about May, you have every state just going for it. You know, you've seen thousands and thousands of bills. And, you know, Stephen, in your home state of Georgia there, you've got 40 days to deal with thousands of bills. And these things take, you know, instantly. I was making a comment on one of the bills and it's already passed. You know, it went through the House and getting ready for the Senate. And so these things move fast.
We're all about efficiency here in Georgia.
I like it. I like it. Just push it through. But I just wanted to go through and for everybody to know that this is happening in every state. And some of the legislative bills going around related to compound, you know, in Arizona, we see that there are five different bills. Illinois has a bill, Iowa, Oklahoma has two. New York is practicing a little bit of protectionism with the when it comes to paying for compounded prescriptions, or an employer or an employer's insurance can deny compounded medication if it's from out of state, if they don't agree with the charges. It's a little interesting, and they have been that way. With it's really hard for an out-of-state pharmacy to register in New York. It's really hard for register in New York. I know one of my clients has been going for almost a year and a half trying to register in the state, and they just keep putting up barriers. COVID was an easy excuse for them for the last little bit, but they seem to really want to keep protect those that are in the state of New York.
But those denying those charges is specifically for non-resident pharmacies.
Correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the employer or carrier will have the right to deny any charges that originate from non-resident out-of-state pharmacies and deny any charges for non-FDA extemporaneous compound medications. So. Yeah,
I was just making sure that and meant of the ones that were out of state pharmacies, and not in addition to out of state pharmacies, they can also. Okay.
As far as I understand,
I'll make sure the lawyers read it, not me.
Yeah, that'd be kind of interesting to look at. Is if you have an out of state pharmacy license and you're authorized and licensed to deliver drugs into the state, I wonder what the due process and equal protection fanatics out there would say about, you know, this protectionism where, you know, hey, I'm licensed to send it into the state, but you're telling them they don't pay me for it. That seems a little problematic to me. I'm interested to see. I'm sure the smart folks have looked through it and figured it out, but it raises some concerns for me.
I don't know. Just for a brief reminder of how a bill gets their ideas, you know, what the path. I used to represent IHOP and Applebee's, and a piece of legislation from New York actually came across my desk when I was working with them. And it was a bill to make sure that, you know how when you walk into a restaurant, you see the blackboard and you see the special up on the blackboard, and sometimes they won't have the prices. It was a bill to make sure that that price was written on that blackboard, or they were aware, because some legislator went into a restaurant, bought it. It was more than he thought it was going to be, and he was upset. So he went and he wrote a bill to make sure that the blackboard now has a price. So that's how bills.
Power is an amazing thing, right?
Interesting.
So pay attention, get involved, be involved. And so, you know,
we any have, other highlights here out of these states, any other big ones that are going to impact folks? You know,
the only one I'm going to say that is comical was the one in Virginia. And I testified on this before, wondering why they were even bringing it up. But a couple of years ago, they brought up a bill that said if a 503B is making a death penalty drug, you know, they have to report it that this is who it was. They couldn't, there was no anonymity for it. They had to say who, you know. But there weren't any 503Bs making the drug. You know, none of them were getting involved. It's really even hard to get the product to even do it. But now, Virginia's in the process of getting rid of the death penalty. So now they want to make sure that they also get rid of that section for the 503Bs. So, okay, you know, you guys are out of the country. Yeah, it was a, once again, you know, the rules and how they go by. So that's probably enough of that. Another topic I wanted to bring up with you guys that about a week ago, everybody was aware of the new book coming out on the New England compound. NECC. And, you know, it's a cautionary tale. You know, what happened, we're all very aware of it. It's something that that impacted our industry pretty heavily. Something that still we're feeling today. Every time the FDA puts out a guidance document for our industry, they make reference to it. So now we have it in book form, and I want to make sure people are aware of the book. I'm not asking you to go read it. I'm not even suggesting that it's a must read to put it on your Christmas giving list. What I am saying though is that it creates another news cycle, and it puts it back out in front of people. And if we're not doing our job with the legislators at the Board of Pharmacies, with our own associations at local level and others, you're letting someone else tell your story. And this is definitely the story, especially in this form. We don't want to, Phillip, Steve, I don't know if you guys have read this at all or looked at the book yet.
I'm just taking a look at the summaries and the general information. It's interesting that the timing of it coming out, I don't think they're related, but there's just a Court of Appeals ruling at the last week or so of February that upheld some of the convictions for some of the lesser players at NECC, some folks who were involved in the shipping of the drugs, and it just upheld the convictions. So it's interesting that it's all kind of at the same time. But Philip, what were your thoughts on the book as you're kind of looking into it?
Well, I mean, I'd say as far as the timing goes, you were always going to hit some news cycle with NECC. I still see every other week, there's still news alerts that I get, and that's what it's about. And again, like, terrible, terrible tragedy. I mean, it was, and I say tragedy, it was completely, it should never have happened, right? And we all know that story. And I'm not going to rehash it here. I really haven't read it. I'm aware of it. I've been aware of it. I've read, you know, as you guys have, I've read some of the summaries. You know, I guess from my standpoint, this is, it's a novel. This is not journalism. As far as I know, the author did not reach out to any compounding pharmacies, pharmacists, APC, any of the groups in order to get additional information. So it's very much a story, and it's very much a you know, I don't know how much of it is based on the journalism. I think it was written by someone who was investigating the tragedy. But again, you know, I think that it's important to realize what it is. And to your point, Aaron, it's not so much that everyone needs to get out and read it. We're all aware of it. You know, most of us lived through it in some form, even if you're just being in the compounding industry at that time, or just are still dealing with the repercussions of it. You know, every single FDA, every time they give a presentation, this is how it starts out. I think it's more about what do we do now and what can we expect from that.
One question I have is I wonder if FDA is going to start actually quoting the book in its morning letters or, you know, its updates about NECC. You know, according to this book, page 12, it said, you know,
yeah, much like the NASM reports, we'll find out who funded the book.
Exactly.
Yeah. See a few of the older FDA, you know, officials signing copies of the book. I was there. The problem was, you know, the story, however, and it doesn't make the FDA look good with this at all. Either, no matter what the FDA will say about it, because, you know, Stephen, you just made a comment that the court just upheld a couple of, you know, of the trial convictions. The thing is, though, it's not like they were convicted under new laws. They were convicted under laws that were present at the time. So they were working illegally at the time. You know, the FDA had an obligation to be in there. The state had an obligation to be in there. And they were convicted under those laws right there. So the laws in and of themselves worked. You know, maybe there were other aspects. These were just bad people, bad actors, you know, no matter what profession. I've always said if they were a used car salesman, if there was something else, a new car, doesn't matter. They would have tried to make the shortcuts.
Yeah, and like I said before, it's your wolf in sheep's clothing. You know, they were not the way they were acting was not a compounding pharmacy. Under the regulations was not a compounding pharmacy. Under the laws was not a compounding pharmacy and was found not to be in violation by the inspections. You know, so again, I hate to keep rehashing it.
Yeah.
One of the things we wanted to talk about is what to do now, right? You know, if since this is out, you know, the new book is out and somebody might read it, a pharmacy may get a phone call, you know, and you want to comment on it, or a patient may ask, hey, I heard about this book or saw it on the news, whatever it might be. How do you respond to that? Yeah. Aaron, what would you suggest a pharmacy do if it gets somebody knocking on the door, giving a call saying, hey, I read this, what's your position on it?
Well, first you have to realize that they're not really looking for, you know, you to tell them the real story of exactly what happened, or listen to you complain about the process. What they're looking for is a soundbite. They want to have a quote from you. They want to use it to say, oh, they were protesting too much, or oh, they were doing this, because they want to sell. I mean, they're trying to sell. Somebody's trying to sell a book. They're trying to sell a news cycle, and they're looking for something. The best probably you can do is say, hey, you know, best person to talk to about this is, and pass them on to, you can pass them on to APC. You know, this is one of the roles, and especially if you're a member of APC, this is what they're there for you to do. They are able to call Medista, or they're able to call Capital. We'll go ahead and we'll take some of those calls. Stephen, I don't know what you would be advising clients.
I agree. I think you got to be cautious, particularly if you're getting a call from somebody from the press. If you get a patient coming in the door, you know, obviously you got a little more leeway. But as you said, there's a motive behind the call when it's coming from someone in the press, and you just need to be mindful of that. And I would recommend, as you said, passing the question off to someone who's prepared and more skilled in communicating with the press. You know, that said, it's my position in most everything that I deal with, that honesty is always the best policy. And having, being true to sound principles, that way you're never having to backtrack and contradict yourself. You got to call a spade, kind of like what, as Philip was earlier, you know, these were bad actors. There were laws in place at the time that they were violating, and we recognize they're violating, and we don't condone that kind of violation, but that is a blip on a radar full of really good compounders out there who are doing the exact opposite. You know, tell the position, but I don't think anybody needs to be coming to the defense of NEC saying, oh, it wasn't that bad, or it was awful. We all acknowledge that, and it should never happen again. So don't sugarcoat something that was not good, but at the same time, you know, turn the conversation to what's really happening out there with 99.9% of the compounding pharmacies out there who are doing a great job.
I think that's a great point. Philip, any last words on that?
Just that from the title, I thought it was a spy thriller. I didn't realize.
I will say, marketing wise, you know, it is great. And you know, I wrote them out for our notes, and I wasn't really going to read them, but the title of the book is Killshot. And come on, that's pretty good. I mean, you're right. Killshot, a shadow industry, a deadly disease.
I mean, it sounds like a spy thriller, right? It's a Killshot. Yeah. Like,
well, you know, that's what one of them says. They say, Killshot, a chilling and thrilling yarn that reads like a Michael Crichton medical mystery. The only problem, all of this has actually happened. I don't know how actually, you know, from the, you know,
but again, there.
But yeah. So, anyways, moving on. Hey, Stephen, we want to kind of turn to you a little bit, our resident legal expert here. We've got a lot going on. I know you're involved, a lot going on with lawsuits and the MOU. We just were hoping to turn to you to get a little bit of an update on where we are.
Yeah, sure. Just a real quick update. This has been a really busy time over the last couple of weeks, and the next 2 weeks will be busy as well in the life cycle of the MOU litigation. For those who are not fully aware, there was a coalition of seven pharmacies that filed suit against FDA and the Commissioner of Health and Human Services and so forth, all in that group there together to challenge the MOU. And they did so on essentially two fronts. You've got a technical procedural side, and you've got your substantive side. Technical procedural side really focused on the language in the MOU saying that the Secretary of Health and Human Services shall issue regulations for essentially implementing the terms of 503A, and that the MOU is not a regulation. They're not regulations that were implemented to do this. And arguing that the MOU is a rule and needed to go through the normal rulemaking procedures that didn't happen. That claiming it's a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, it's a violation of the Regulatory Flexibility Act. And then, and so challenging it on that procedural standpoint, that it shouldn't even have been issued. And then looking at the MOU itself, they turned to more substantive issues of the FDA's redefinition of the terms dispense and distribute. And what that turns into is called a Chevron analysis in the legal world, where you're looking to determine whether whether Congress spoke unambiguously and directly on this topic within the statute. Yes, no. If the answer is yes, you go with what Congress said. If the answer is no, it's kind of ambiguous, and you got to take a second step and figure out what did Congress mean. And so that's kind of the challenge that's been happening. Well, in recent days, we had a number of groups that filed amicus briefs, and those are briefs that are filed by interested players who are not necessarily parties to the case. They're not one of the seven pharmacies. They're not affiliated with FDA, but they're interested. We had a group that Medisco was a part of, a group signed on to an amicus brief along with APC and CAPS and PCCA and NCPA and NutriShare. They filed an amicus brief supporting a motion for summary judgment that had been filed by that coalition, and really focusing on those procedural issues and how it's a rule and they didn't go through the rulemaking process. And I represented a couple more pharmacies with a national reach that filed a separate amicus brief focusing less on the procedural side and more on the substantive dispense distribute side, and giving some of the background and context for what's happening there. So that all happened with about 2 weeks ago. And then earlier this week, it was FDA's deadline for filing their response brief and their cross motion for summary judgment, trying to get the case dismissed. Now, FDA, in their response brief, they focused on, again, procedural issues. They wanted a motion to dismiss for lack of standing by these parties, saying, hey, you haven't established that you're actually gonna be harmed by this MOU. It's an MOU between the state and the FDA. You're not a party to the MOU. There's no real clear indication yet how this will actually affect you, how much of a burden the state is gonna pass along to you. And saying that essentially it's not ripe yet. We need to wait until enforcement actions happened or until your state has signed and is burdening you with these obligations. So that was the brief that was recently filed by FDA on Wednesday. And then what we've got coming up here in the next few weeks, next week, the original coalition's response brief, reply brief is due. And then 2 weeks after that, the FDA's final reply brief is due. So the parties have put this more on a fast track. They recognize that we got 365 days before FDA begins enforcing. And they are trying to get this thing decided by the court before that happens. So most of the main briefing will happen by April. And then I'm assuming it'll get put before the court for some sort of oral argument, hopefully in May or so, May or June, and then the decisions will be made. So been very interesting. One quick thought that I want to kind of share that I took away as I was reading through all these briefs. You know, FDA took a very interesting position in its reply brief that because Congress didn't define the terms dispense and distribute within the 503A, Congress was implying that it was deferring to FDA to define it, those terms in the MOU, as opposed to simply using the traditional definitions that have been used, you know, a variety of different places in both federal and state statute. And then FDA mentions that those definitions only apply to the MOU. They don't necessarily apply to other statutes and sections. So it raises the question to me that if that's the case, if it only applies, these definitions only apply to the MOU, then what definitions get applied to those pharmacies located in states that reject the MOU?
Interesting.
If it only applies within the MOU and they're not under the MOU, if you are now enforcing the 5% limit, are you enforcing 5% limit on distribution as traditionally defined? Or 5% of distribution as defined under the MOU, which includes dispensing. That's going to be an interesting thing to look at as we go forward. So I don't want to get too much more into the opinions things on, because it's, you know, it's an active case, but you know, very interesting arguments being made on both sides.
So Stephen, let me ask you a question though. Isn't that kind of dangerous for the FDA to play that kind of a game? And wouldn't it be kind of unnerving for the court to go, because I mean, if we start saying that, you know, we could be applying that to a lot of statutes then that right. Give that use a common phrase, however, you know, didn't define it within that statute, then other people would say, well, no, that it only applies to here and this is what it means. I mean, why use two different words if we're meaning the same thing?
It's a very slippery slope. They call it, you know, in the legal profession, that, you know, one small step may not be a big deal, but the problem is the next step is off a cliff, right? Yeah. And so it's concerning because it is a huge power maneuver. If I can take a term and define it however I want within this small component of what I'm doing, well, there's small components of what FDA is doing all over the place. And it's one thing, it might be understandable if this is a not a very widely used term and it's not well defined. No one really knows what it means. Like, we're gonna fine tune the definition. But when you turn a definition on its head and go completely contradictory to what is used throughout federal statute and almost all state statutes, now you're creating law. This is a rule. And that's exactly what the coalition is saying. This is a rule change. You're substantively changing definitions, which are directly impacting folks without going through the rulemaking process that Congress requires to. So
Stephen, let's say the court rules in the coalition's favor, and they have to go in and, you know, distribution means exactly what we all understand it to mean, with all the states defined as other statutes defined to mean, and defense. I would think that one, they would have to almost start fresh with the MOU again. But what is the ultimate goal with these lawsuits? What are they hoping for?
You know, I don't want to speak for the coalition that's filed, but I think the ultimate goal is to make sure that there is going to be an MOU. There will be. It's in the statute. There must be an MOU. Yeah. So that's not a goal. The goal is making sure that the MOU follows the intent of Congress and what it intended to regulate and the scope of involvement it intended for FDA to have in resolving or addressing the interstate distribution of inordinate amounts of compounded drugs. That's the clear, plain language of the statute. And so I think that the goal is to go back, have the MOU drafted where it complies with congressional intent, and to the extent it's going to try to substantively change things in any way, it's got to go through the rulemaking procedure. And, you know, if something happens and you don't like it, but it went through the proper procedures, it kind of is what it is, right? You got to go back through legislative channels to change it. But that didn't happen here. So I think the groups, you can live with things that you maybe don't love if it went through the proper procedures and it's just how it ended up. But when you get something that is very draconian and you didn't go through the process, that's the rub.
Yeah, but I think that go ahead, Philip.
No, the redefinition is obviously, it's always been at the crux, the dispense distribute, but it's an interesting way that you put it there. You know, if you can go back and rewrite things that are actually defined in other statutes, it's not like it's a word that's undefined, is not, you know, these terms exist, but they're going back and rewriting then what they mean. Like, you can do that with anything. I mean, going forward, as every single every single piece of legislation going to have a definition of every single term used in that document in order to make sure that someone like the FDA can't go retroactively redefining terms.
So here's the problem though with legislation. When you write legislation, you've got to be really careful, because if you define it too much and you put in too strict of things, well, then it's not, you know, 10 years down the road, you might have to revisit it and redo the whole thing,
right?
Because it's not, you know, new technologies, new whatever, other things, and you're pretty stuck. And I tell people, I like living in the world with gray, not just my hair, but I like living in a world of gray because it lets you evolve a little bit with it. So, okay, well, we can do this, we can. And when this legislation passed, I think the industry as a whole looked at it, were we excited about it? I think exactly to Stephen's point, it wasn't exactly what we want, but we went through the process, we came to an agreement. This is where we understand the legislators are. We get what it is. So 95% of it, we could live within these guidelines. You know, it was just, nobody knew the interpretation that was going to happen when it went over to the FDA, even with letters of congressional intent being pushed over to the FDA and whatever. So that's why I'm fascinated by this. I know you said brief, Stephen, but we're going to talk about it for a long time.
Yeah,
because it's just fascinating.
Well, It's important.
Yeah. And right now, NABP, I just saw recently their survey has come out, and they've identified at this point, from people who've states have responded to their surveys, that Florida and Idaho have confirmed they're not signing at this point. Mm-hmm. And there are a handful of others or a lot of others that are still undecided, some of whom are also saying, you know, we're probably not inclined to sign. So this can be a big deal for pharmacies, for example, in in Florida. There are lots of them down there, and you know, it's a big deal. Idaho as well.
So one last question on this, because it's the question I think everyone wants to know. Can this legislation either halt the date or push it back or freeze the time that's going on as far as the MOU, that October, November?
Sure. Can the litigation do that? It would require one of the parties or both of them jointly to file a request for stay or an injunction on the issuance. I've heard discussion of possibly perhaps Congress, you know, given the fact they drafted the statute, could potentially request a stay. Right now, there's no motion pending to hold off this enforcement beginning at 365 days. That's why it's on the fast track for decision. But that certainly is an option. If they're still working through it and haven't gotten there, it'd certainly be something that they could request the court to put a stay while it's continuing to evaluate what it wants to do.
So I think, Philip, just to follow a little bit along with what you're saying, and Stephen, I know you're totally aware with it. You know, so you got guys like me, lobbying and government affairs. Is, you know, I've now got to protect the industry. Do I let Florida dangle out there and say, hey, we'll use you as a test case, you know, to do this? Let Idaho dangle out there and say, I'll use you as a test case, saying, yeah, people can ship into the state. They just can't ship out of the state. And you know, basically putting all of those pharmacies, you know, businesses that, you know, at a disadvantage with that. Or do I go in and I push for it, say, hey, you know, you've got to sign it just because I want to protect those pharmacies. Do I let them go through this? It's a hard decision.
You know, it is hard. And, you know, as a litigator, you know, if I put away my feeling side and the feeling that I have for these, it's a tragic outcome for all these pharmacies that'll be hung out to dry. But I would like to see at least one state dig their heels and say, I'm not doing this. You know, Florida would be a great one because it has so many pharmacies there who are going to be directly impacted. It would take away the standing defenses from FDA and the rightness, because, you know, once they start enforcing, it's immediately they've got standing and it's ripe and it's direct. And they, you know, at that point you challenge an actual enforcement action. Now, nobody wants to be the guinea pig. Nobody wants to be the one hung out there to be the test case, but somebody may have to do it if this lawsuit or any others that might be filed are not successful at cutting it off at the knees.
And Stephen, this is only for the 503As, right? This does not affect the 503Bs.
Correct. And that's not even all the 503As. That's one last point. That's the point. But yeah, you know, there's an argument that FDA makes in its briefs you know, hey, there is a recourse. If you don't like the MOU, become a 503B and you're just fine. The problem is 503B only applies to sterile compounding. So what happens to all the non-sterile compounders out there who can't transition to a 503B because they're non-sterile? It's, you know, again, there are arguments being made on all sides of the issue, and there's so many different layers. And so
doesn't this only apply to human drugs?
Only human
as well,
drugs, no, right? Animal drugs, no no 503B activity.
Correct. Yep. Stephen, thank you. I know this is going to be a continuing story saga. You know, you could probably write your own kill shot book on this one.
We'll circle back around next month after the reply briefs have been filed later this month by the coalition and by FDA, and we'll have everything in front of us and kind of see how the landscape is established going into potential oral arguments.
We appreciate you digging into it and going through all of those. When you sent over the copies of those documents that were filed, I'm like, woof.
Pretty thick, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty thick. So I want to go ahead and turn now after the MOU update. Philip, if we can kind of turn to you a little bit. I understand you've got an update for us as well. So something fresh, hot off the presses.
Yeah, fresh off the presses. APC on the 5th here of March in their release this information. And speaking of thick documents, this one's 291 pages as well. So APC revealed that, in their words, they see unambiguous evidence of bias in the NASM report. So there was a coalition of compounding pharmacies, another coalition of compounding pharmacies that's discovered, they filed a Freedom of Information Act request of the FDA and NASM to find out what was going on here between the FDA, who hired NASM to the tune of, I think, $1.3 million to create the report, And the Freedom of Information Act, the timeline came and went. They still weren't getting the information. This was filed back at the end of July, if I'm remembering right. They were supposed to respond within 20 days. I believe they only just got the information in the past month or so. And they believe this is a smoking gun, really. You know, that the FDA, in their words, was stacking the deck, that they were basically handpicking who should be included in, as a HRT expert, which I think we kind of thought was the case. A lot of them actually didn't have any. They didn't include a prescriber of BHRT. All of that was known. But also they informed NASM ahead of time as to what they wanted from this document, which is fascinating and really setting the stage for months in advance of the actual meetings happening regarding here's information, here's what we want you to look at, here's basically creating undue influence on the what's supposed to be, what's theoretically was hired to be its own independent article or report is what I always say. It's certainly not a study, so report. So it's fascinating. And like I said, they filed 291 pages of documents. And I haven't had a chance to go through all of them yet because it's so fresh. But it certainly sheds another light and a whole nother layer on the NASM reports that we all fear greatly going to impact this industry in the next couple of years.
Philip, I want to take this opportunity to go ahead and say I have been extremely impressed, especially as of late, the effort that APC, this is, I'm going to do another plug for APC if you're not a member.
Because we like APC.
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing, I mean, look at what they really are doing to protect your industry. They're going after, you know, the unfairness of the MOU, you know, to making sure that it's a level playing field for everybody there. They're, you know, with NASM, I mean, this is something that it's a threat, but it's not a present threat. In other words, we're not reacting to it. We are very much, you know, forward thinking in it and making sure that it doesn't become an issue. And this is incredible. And things like this will have ramifications in the way, you know, I'm all for the pushback against the FDA. The FDA at the very beginning of all this, they were just running all over us. And we were thinking, well, we got to be careful how we push back because we don't want to poke the bear. Well, the bear's awake and the bear is coming. And APC has done a great job going ahead.
Yeah,
I think something like this is incredible.
And full disclosure there, I am a board member of APC as of this year. So while I'm promoting them, I should say that. It's but I agree. I think a lot of the work that APC is doing recently and going forward in the next couple of years is work that is paramount to the industry. And if you're not supporting them, you should be.
Well, and I'm going to call them out by name. I think Scott has done a fantastic job.
Agreed.
I agree with you on the great work that APC is doing. I know they've been reaching out a lot for donations and support, but this stuff they're doing costs a lot of money. I mean, they're getting in front of things. They're hiring law firms to file briefs. I mean, it takes time and money, and it's money that's being well used, it appears. So,
the compounders that have stepped up.
And correct. I was going to say that this was done by a coalition of compounders, and APC is coordinating now with them. But it was led by the compounders and Rachel Pontikis and her group there as well.
And I will tell you, when I was in the insurance world, you know, with Farmers Insurance, the coalition that we were a part of, we had to give a percentage of our earnings to the association. You know, depending on the size of the thing, and you know, APC isn't asking for that. You know, I'm just saying.
But you can do that. You can give a percentage of.
Yeah. Let me ask you. It was like 20%.
Let me ask you guys: if these findings from this open the Information Act documentation they obtained, if this gets legs. Okay, you know, maybe we just scratch the surface here to see how involved FDU was. I mean, I understand from, you know, kind of reading kind of some blurbs on it that, you know, they were giving recommendations for who should be on the committee and trying to put people on there who they knew were very favorable to FDA's position and you know, no one who's an acting CBHRT prescriber, things like that. But if this gains legs, I wonder, you know, is this something that can be used the same way FDA uses NECC over and over and over again to show that, hey, this is why we were concerned about compounders. Is this going to be something can be used as evidence of, here's why we're concerned about FDA's overreach? You know, and this just comes up again and again. You remember the Nason report, right? I mean, I wonder to what extent this could be used kind of as a pushback saying, hey guys, you know, now we've shed some light on everything we've been concerned about, but this is direct evidence of what we've been saying.
Great thought.
I think it has a couple of effects. I think one, it gives us a tool in our arsenal to go ahead and say, look, you know, this is the way we've been treated for a while. Can you please help us clarify some other things to make sure that they don't go wrong? Or help might help reduce one or two guidance documents, you know, down the road to go ahead and say, we need to reevaluate that. I think what it also does on the FDA side, it slows them down quite a bit. And if they are found to have meddled too much, you know, please remember, they're that, just as involved they were with NASEM, that's exactly how involved they are with USP. And with some other things. So maybe those things start getting a little sunshine as well. And then it makes them, they normally do a pretty good job of covering their tracks and say, realizing through the FDA, but also saying, look, these are the processes, we're gonna go through the processes to end up here. They might just hold down on those. I mean, and remember, we haven't had a PCAF meeting for 2 years now. And what are they leading up to? This might have an impact on how they look at some of those products and some of those things that they bring before the PCAC as well. And might influence, to your point, Stephen, maybe it influences who sits on the PCAC as well.
I mean, why would we believe that this is an isolated incident? Like, what evidence do we have that this is the only time that this has ever happened and that they've lined things up in the way that they have, right? Like, I think it's reasonable to expect that at least the way that they treat our industry, that this is more of a, this is not an outlier, I guess.
So, but Philip, to that, you also have to look at our industry. Look at what is the size of our industry compared to some of the others. And I mean, we've now got a bestseller book, you know, coming out about our industry, but it's not to say that there aren't other things. It's just for traditionally, we have not come together on topics. And I think, Stephen, when this first broke, you and I were commenting on how coalescing this really has become. And I think that if we can come together, show the strength of the industry and show what it is and be able to push it, I think it's going to make a huge difference. It's a model to use forward.
Yeah, and I absolutely think it needs to be used as a grounds for demanding or insisting upon compounders on, you know, PCAC, you know, and active folks, you know, these things that we've been requesting for years, but you don't need it. It's saying, no, because of this example, and probably the same thing with USP, and because of the other, we need somebody on that, you know, that I think it should be used for that purpose. Again, assuming this is just scratching the surface and we're able to further develop what appears to be the case from this initial evaluation.
Well, with that in mind, we did get another FDA warning that came out. How long ago, Philip? It wasn't that long ago, but
10 days.
It was in February, right?
Yeah. So it was interesting in looking at this, and I was trying to remember. So I'm not a pharmacist. They came out and we were talking about thymosin alpha 1, and I hope I'm saying that right. But I think, Philip, back in October, that was the NPR discussion that came out of people compounding COVID products. I think this is a result of that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's where this came out of.
Yeah, I think that you're right. And I'm trying to remember that as well, that I remember that there was a news story that I had heard on NPR. And it was pretty quick, but it had to do with people compounding. Yeah, I think it had to do with the FDA when they pushed before that people were marketing, you know, COVID they were compounders that were doing products, and they were ultimately marketing them as COVID products. But again, I can't remember the details there, but certainly, I mean, thymosin, I mean, we're talking about peptides. Peptides are not a new conversation for compounders. You know, even again, APC just in their last EDUCON had a short thing about it. There's been webinars. I mean, we've talked about the I'll call it gray, but really it's a pretty dark gray area as far as the compounding of peptides. I guess I'll let the lawyer speak to that more than me. But.
Well, even I think beyond that, you know, Stephen, I will turn to you. I think one of these things that I've always tried to tell people is know the law, follow the law with it. And there are certain things that we can compound from and certain things that we can't. And this doesn't appear to fall under those things. Not because of the peptide or anything, but because it doesn't fall under our category. Oh, you're on mute, Stephen. It was a good answer, I'm sure.
Sorry, I've clicked on the. Their initial indication. I've seen some published studies that hey, it seems like it reduces the mortality rate of COVID-19 in severe cases, and so there's some positive science behind it. But at the end of the day, you got to make sure you're following the compounding rules. If this is not something you can compound from, unfortunately, you can't do it. Is there possibly getting a kind of a EUA kind of a thing to enable people to do it? Probably not, maybe, who knows, but unless you're there, you're not there. So
this API is going through the process right now, so it's not an FDA approved drug, but it's in I believe that it's in a stage two of a drug trial,
which is a long way from approval.
I'm not familiar with that, So, but it is being looked at, and maybe that's where somebody heard of it. And Stephen, to your point, it's tested, positive points to it. However, those products that aren't a part of an FDA approved drug or that don't have a monograph or isn't on the secretary's list, are not in our realm. They're not in the field of what we can compound. And this, to everything that I've looked for, it is not on those lists. So, but it's out there. We bring it up to just let you know that, making sure you're aware of it, that the FDA is looking at it, especially for the claims. I think Philip, you were saying that if you're making a claim on this, you've got to be very careful. You're making a claim on anything, on any of our products.
Any compound. You don't have marketing authorization for these products, right? You're filling a need that's coming to you. Not that you're out there saying this is going to cure XYZ. Because you haven't done the research, you haven't done the studies. You hasn't gone through the proper channels in order to claim that.
Right. So moving on, we just wanted to make you aware of that. Yep. And of course, the thing I wanted to point out mostly is Phil, how did we get this warning?
Oh yeah, big old press release, right to your email. I'm sure most of the people that would be listening to this also sign up for the FDA alerts, and you get it. I think I got three of them that day from the FDA.
Correct. So, I mean, it's out
for
there.
For the handful of compounding pharmacies that may be doing this.
If a handful, but yeah.
Yeah.
But it's out there. It's plastered on their website and for everybody to see. And it'll probably be coming out a couple of times. So we just want to let you know that the spotlight will be shined upon the uranium industry. Things like that. So moving, putting that aside, moving right along, because, I think, Bill, to your point, 99.9% of everybody is doing what they're supposed to do, doing the right things. And that's where we're hoping that's where we want the light to shine.
Where we want to stay.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to some of the interpretations of Stephen, the way you were kind of explaining to us how the statute is being read and when the legislation was passing, what we thought was okay. When they had given us the ability to compound things from our list, the monographs, that opens up. That's a pretty broad range of products. But the FDA, in their interpretation, did cut down a third of those things. Dietary supplement monograph, almost assuming that it's a lesser monograph. USP has never come out and said anything to that degree. But in the FDA's mind, They said, well, you know, there are certain stipulations that have to go along with the dietary supplement. So we want to make sure that those aren't something on it. If you want that product to be used, if you want that HPI to be any part of the product, you have to you have to go through the process. Three, you put it on list three, make sure it has all the information to be one, to be reviewed, then to put on the secretary's positive list for compounders to use.
Aaron, question for you. You made a comment there as you're speaking a moment ago about how USP is not commenting on the quality of the USP monograph as it relates to dietary supplements in response to these concerns that FDA is raising that, hey, it's not on the same level as a drug monograph. Any insight? Philip, Aaron, either you guys, why is USP not speaking up and saying, hey, FDA, these are our monographs. We go through a rigorous process to do this. They're called different things, but it's similarly of similar quality. Why are we not hearing from USP?
It's the same quality. Hold on. It's the same quality. So it's a USP dietary supplement monograph. And my understanding is we're talking about USP monograph, of which dietary supplement is a portion. So I think, and Aaron, I'll toss this to you, but my understanding was originally when the FDA did start to make this distinction, USP did push back a little bit. Is that accurate?
Well, so I will tell you, when the definition came out, you really have to go back and say, because the FDA said there's a drug monograph and a dietary supplement monograph. You'll be hard pressed, especially when they first come out with this, to find anything that defined what a drug monograph was. I never saw the term. We never went through. I went through the USP with another lawyer going through. We couldn't find that. And the only reason why anything is designated as a dietary supplement was, in talking with USP, ease of use, to go ahead and find that section of it, so people understood that, well, these were dietary supplements, and these are the rest of the APIs. And in speaking with with USP, they did. They said, well, let's get our lawyers on this. Why are they making this claim? Why is FDA saying this? We're going to do it. And for about a week, I would say they were pretty interested in kind of pushing back. Then all of a sudden, silence, from USP. And you have to kind of realize the relationship between the FDA and USP. And this is kind of the nascent issue that we were talking about a little bit as well. On every
the FDA thing, wouldn't try to influence an independent organization.
Well, if the USP like NASA wants,
or USP.
Well, if USP wants to have the standing that it does and continue to be mentioned by name in regs and mentioned by whatever, this is cynical side of going through it. But on all of these committees, they might not have an official position on the committees, but they're always part of the discussion. They're always part of the pushback. And this is a fear, you want to be recognized, you get the recognition as being the authority in there. You want a governing body to grant you that authority for it. And so they have to be very careful in the way that they come out and say that.
Could this be resolved simply by USP redefining terms, or changing terms, where instead of having a dietary supplement monograph, it's just a USP monograph? I mean, does that resolve it as like that?
It could. I mean, there are interconnected things. You also have to realize that there is a dietary supplement CGMP, program that they've got. And those products go in hand with that regulation as well. So those are the interplays. And the biggest thing that the FDA is coming out with, and the reason why the FDA is really coming out against it, is because in those definitions, in those regs, for they call it an oral product. And we don't always use it for an oral substance. So that's when their fears that they say that a drug monograph has to test for these other impurities, but there are dietary supplement monographs that are stronger and, are more strict than a lot of the other drug monographs. So to come out with a blanket statement like that is hard. And maybe, Stephen, to your point, maybe there is a designation in there to go ahead and go through and look at them. But the thing is that the FDA didn't have to go through that and get rid of all monographs or all the dietary supplements. They could have gone in restricted to dosage forms. They've done it before. Why not look at it that way than just cutting off a third of all access? So there's a lot of questions, and you know, talking about congressional intent, we have sent letters from Congress up to the FDA saying this was our intent, and the FDA wrote back and said, well, if that was your intent, that's how you should do it. Anyway, so I bring this topic up not to have this. I know we've had this thought. I think the FDA's biggest ploy with all of this is that they are looking to regulate all of dietary supplements, not I think it was easy for them to start with it. And I think they're going to start going after other segments of the dietary supplement market, the manufacturers and whatever, and saying, we want to rein in those as well. And we were the easiest easiest target on that list, and saying, look, if we're not going to let the pharmacists do it, why are we going to let you guys?
You know, Aaron, that may be very, you know, very true. I have a little different perspective on it. I think that probably is the case. I think FDA is looking at what are the key segments of the compounding business, and they're squeezing. You squeeze BHRT, you squeeze pain creams, you squeeze any kind of TRICARE reimbursements you have with those. We then squeeze pain dietary cream. Supplements. You know, so each of these components that keep compounders in business, if I can take them away one at a time, and I can take away, you know, Ophthalgics, for example, and 503Bs, and I'm shrinking the market share, the potential for business for 503As to where it's this industry that's not regulated by FDA becomes very, very small. And I think as long as they can't regulate them, let's narrow it as much as possible. And I think your point is also a good point. I think, you know, hey, FDA also wants to regulate dietary supplements, so this is a good starting point, but I think it's part of a larger effort to narrow the scope of an unregulated, quote unquote, industry.
It's not an either or. I think it's more of an and, right? Like I think both can certainly be true in this case. And, you know, it's just interesting to me, you know, to your point, Stephen, you know, that they would go after the one that's actually more regulated, right? Like we're in a far more regulated portion right now than say the dietary supplements that are sitting on the shelf at GNC or what have you, you know, because we're actually going through a physician who's monitoring a patient. You're working with a pharmacist who's making something that's actually the API has been tested because they get it from reputable sources. It's made to the needs of that patient by under the purview of a physician's care. So, I mean, you're talking about very much a population that's being looked after, being monitored, versus, you know, somebody going and buying whatever they want and taking as much as they want. And there are fewer testing, you know, as the New York, what was the one, the New York investigation regarding nutraceuticals, where they found so many to be out of spec, all of that. So, I mean, it's interesting that they would come after us. Number one, because I think they come after us. And then number two, that they would just be trying to take this segment away from us, you know, to your point.
Well, you know, I think my big intent, and first of all, I'm glad to see my cynicism wearing off on other people. That's great. But we've got a new administration. We're getting a new FDA commissioner. We probably won't have him in place until May, because we still have to get the Health and Human Secretary, you know, appointed. We still have to go through that. And I think, Philip, you and I have been hearing that they're looking at a couple different possibilities. You know, Janet Woodcock is the front runner, as far as I'm aware of. But they're looking at another doctor or a person from Johns Hopkins as well. And we're unable to really truly predict where we're able to go, or what the full agenda is going to be until the FDA commissioner is appointed. But you know, the iron's hot for them to go ahead and move forward. And with that, I know APC is looking at dietary supplements. Medisca, this has been one of the things that they have tasked me with for a while there. We've got appropriations language that we have in years before. We've got done other things. And I think you and I have worked, especially with the delegation from Ohio, to help with some of that language. Now's the time to try to go in and try to fix it, try to save that segment of the industry. And that might just be a legislative fix that we'll have to go in and to totally clarify that.
Yeah, and with APC on their federal legislative committee, and we do have a subcommittee that's focused on sort of the path forward for dietary supplements, and it's looking at across the board. It's looking at the language to get one of our members of Congress or Senate, depending, to submit to question the new FDA commissioner as well, to get on the record sort of their state. We are looking at talking and having communication, hopefully, with USP. You know, we are looking at possible like standalone legislation regarding dietary supplement, because like you said, I think it's ripe. You know, it's something that we can educate. I think it's pretty clear that it's not what Congress intended. You know, we've had them sign letters previously. So, from my standpoint, I'd like to see, you know, all guns blazing here. You know, again, it's not a either or, it's why aren't we doing all of these things, you know, and trying to move it forward, but doing it in obviously the right way, making sure that we do them at the right time and laying out a good game plan here. So,
well, and we've seen the success of what large groups, you know, can do to help effectuate some of the change here. Mm-hmm. You know, stay aware of what's going on, and we'll keep you updated as things move forward. If legislation does pop up, if other things do pop up, we'll keep you informed on what's going out. Now, our final topic is the FDA has come out within the last month their look forward on what guidances they're going to come out with. I have never known them not to have completed everything on the list. It might have, you know, linked into the following year a little bit, but they have pretty much tried to come out with everything that is on their list. So just as a quick recap of some of them, they're looking at updating the essential copies for both 5A and 503A and 503B guidance documents. They're looking to go ahead and clean up the hospital and healthcare system compounding, what that looks like. And my fear there is we always thought we were going to get three different sets of rules, 503A rule, a 503B rule, and then a hospital system rule. Hopefully they're not going to vary too much because it's just a bit of confusion, but at least they are recognizing that, you know, the reason why compounding pharmacies are so nimble is because they have to be nimble because of the situation, the rules that they're trying to fit. And then safety considered, another guidance document, safety considerations for container labels. And I believe that's for 503Bs, and that's the guidance. But the one I want to focus on and one I want to bring Philip and Stephen your attention to is the prohibition on wholesaling under Section 503B of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic. And we've talked about this in generalities before on this, and Stephen, in our discussion before the program, you talked about Nevada looking to go ahead and do something. Just to kind of give an idea and understanding of what they're basically saying is, when is it okay to dispense a drug product? When is it, can I dispense a prescription for a manufactured product? Okay, well, if a 503B product is a manufactured product and I'm able to have it for office use, can I, as a physician, dispense that product as well? Can I dispense a 503A product? But we're focusing just on the 503B aspect of it. And I think currently, and Stephen and you and I have talked about this before, different states have allowed for it. There are several states that have gone through and said that in their regs, said, you know, here you are, a clinic, you went ahead and you received this bulk substance to have a profit. So you're also allowed to now go ahead and dispense that for 7 days, you know, 20 days or whatever their rules would say, but you're treating it as a manufactured product. Then you have other states, this is what I found it did, and said, no, what we don't want to do is allow for that to be dispensed. If a 503B is going to dispense it, they have to dispense it directly from their facility that manufactured it. They can't send it to the doctor who can dispense it.
The question is, there's the rule prohibiting wholesale distribution by 503Bs and reselling of drugs with an exception. Exception to the rule is administration or dispensing. And the real question is, who does dispensing apply to? Right. Some, you know, Nevada and some folks are saying, well, dispensing only applies to 503B. The 503B is administering it, which only ever happens. Maybe David does, but or dispensing, that's the exception. And everyone else is saying, no. What you're saying is 503Bs can give it for office use for administration or dispensing by the prescriber or the practitioner. And to me, reading the language, it seems pretty clear the intent is this is an exception allowing to for the resale, even though that the prescriber practitioner is quote unquote reselling it by dispensing it to a patient with a fee or a charge, that's acceptable practice for a 503B. But we're seeing folks in Nevada, and I'm assuming FDA would probably, given what we've seen, if they take the approach that we want to keep this as narrow as possible. It doesn't seem as confusing as it's being made out to be, that this is a clear exception to the wholesale prohibition in 503B.
I would agree with you. I think my only pushback on that is that I know we've had discussions as a 503B group going and speaking with the FDA about it. I know other groups have talked about it with them, and they at least paid us some lip service that they were leaning and granted, I understand. They could say one thing and write a completely other thing, not as if we haven't seen that before. But my hope is that they will come out and allow for the 503Bs to continue to allow their products to be dispensed. Because where I'm seeing the biggest problem is that you take a healthcare or system, if a 503B were to distribute its products to the local pharmacy there, then the pharmacy will then have to go ahead and dispense it out to their patients from that pharmacy. They'll have to ship it to other departments, they'll have to ship it to other things, but it doesn't go to a storage facility at the hospital, it goes to the pharmacy. And then the pharmacy has to then turn around and still, push it out. And where does it go? Could there be a confusion there? I don't know. They'd have to really come out and really clean a lot of that up.
And as I see it, this really, it's a protectionist provision. It's trying to protect the wholesalers and manufacturers in keeping 503Bs out of that realm. I would anticipate the ultimate decision is going to be based upon how much pushback FDA gets from Big Pharma. How much of their market are they trying to protect with this provision? And is it a concern to enable 503Bs to have practitioners dispense what they're providing them? I don't think it has, from what I can tell, it doesn't have any real clinical safety precaution or protection here by not letting it be the dispense. It's simply a keeping these folks small, not letting them be on working on a grand scale.
Correct. I mean, to your point right there, if the 503B is, in Michigan and the patient is in Arizona, if the 503B ships it safely to a location in Arizona for a doctor to dispense it there, is that worse than having the 503B in Michigan ship it directly to the patient? It's still going through the catalyst, plastic, through all that. I think it'd be safer if the doctor had the opportunity to inspect it, look at it, and whatever person is dispensing it there to be able to go ahead and take a look at that before it hands it over to a patient.
Yeah, it seems like the essentially copy protections should be sufficient to protect the market share without having to further limit dispensing by practitioners.
Well, and that I think gets into the, if you're making it because of drug shortages, then isn't it a good thing to make it more available to people? And where does that come in as far as wholesaling, but what about drop shipping? You order it, but it's actually getting sent directly from that pharmacy to whoever is actually ordering it. They're just ordering it through this mechanism. The chain of custody of the drug itself isn't actually going through the wholesale channel. It's actually going from one entity to another. So where does that leave that?
Well, it's interesting where, a lot of this is just kind of speculation of which way they're going to go. When they finally come out with the document, you can bet a log break out all red pins and go through and highlight it and mark it up. And I'm going to guess that there's going to be a lot of comment periods on both sides of trying to, you know, say, yay, FDA, you did it right, or hey, FDA, we think you need to be a little bit more strict than that. So, but with that, guys, we've covered all the topics I think that we need to cover for this last month. And I know we're getting into a warmer season, and I think this is the first time we haven't talked about COVID and what's going on. Just a real quick, it looks like Johnson & Johnson's coming out with the new one, and hopefully we can get a lot of this behind us. Any last words?
Pleasure working with you guys. Stay healthy and safe, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. It's another exciting month. 2021 should be a interesting year for all of us. So make sure you keep tuning in. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for your expertise. And
just thank you to Modesca for allowing us a venue and a platform to go ahead and have these discussions. We appreciate that. Philip, Stephen, thank you. And with that, guys, have a great month. Be safe.
Thanks.